Deutschlandfunk. Sport am Feiertag.
Rassismusvorfälle gibt es natürlich nicht nur in Spanien, sondern weltweit. Auch in den USA. Größtenteils gegen schwarze AthletInnen. Der Sportwissenschaftler Joseph N. Cooper beschäftigt sich an der University of Massachusetts in Boston schon lange mit dieser Thematik, forscht unter anderem über schwarze AthletInnen an amerikanischen Colleges und den Aktivismus von schwarzen Sportlerinnen und Sportlern. In den USA wird jeden Februar im sogenannten Black History Month auch an die Erfolge und Leistungen von schwarzen Sportlerinnen und Sportlern erinnert. Ich habe Joseph Cooper vor der Sendung gefragt, wieso das vor allem in überwiegend weißen Gesellschaften so wichtig ist.
So when we think about highlighting the achievements of black athletes, I think the base question that has to be answered, and particularly when you think about societies like the United States, which were founded primarily on the dehumanization of black people. So the idea of blacks being viewed as property, three-fifths of a person when the U.S. Constitution was signed, and the transatlantic atrocity where people were enslaved across various continents and treated more as commodities than humans, when you celebrate achievements in sport of blacks, number one, it signifies that you recognize their humanity. Because throughout the generations of settler colonialism internationally, one of the primary mechanisms by which groups have been controlled and dominated is the erasure of their achievements. And that includes in sport, that includes in education, in the sciences and business, et cetera, agriculture, you name it. So highlighting the achievements celebrates diversity and inclusion, and it fosters more equity and equality in society through sport.
But isn't it sort of counterproductive to focus solely on race and reducing a certain athlete to the color of their skin?
That's a great point. I don't look at it as reducing it to the color of their skin. I think what oftentimes when we eliminate the color of their skin, we engage in what Eduardo Benilla Silva describes as colorblind racism. And if you don't acknowledge the fact that if you just said, well, just athletes, let's not talk about race, let's not talk about gender, what will happen is that it actually allows disproportionate coverage to persist and go unchecked. So I think celebrating the significance of black athletes, as well as women athletes, athletes with unique abilities, athletes across a diverse range of backgrounds, I think it's important to the point, I don't think that's the only factor that should be highlighted, but I do think that it is important to acknowledge, particularly when you're talking about pioneers and breaking barriers, because systematically, certain groups have been denied access to opportunities. So acknowledging that there was a form of oppression based on race means that I think it's important to acknowledge race now, but it doesn't have to be the only factor. And I think it's also important when we highlight black achievements that we aren't perpetuating damaging stereotypes. I've heard so many commentaries across multiple sports where black athletes are described in animalistic terms. Wow, he's a freak. Oh, he freakishly athletic and he's a beast. And, you know, that's a workhorse. I mean, all of these terms that are very offensive. I don't think the people saying it are cognizant of how offensive the language is, because one definition of privilege is the luxury of not having to think about it or to be adversely impacted by whatever is being done. So I think there's a level of privilege and kind of a veil of colorblindness that many of these commentators embody. Another thing that we still see today is that white athletes or those of European descent are often described in terms of being, you know, intellectually talented, hardworking, strategic. And then when the black athletes, the commentary still remains, oh, they're naturally athletic, they're fast. So I still think that a lot of the media coverage is racialized as well as gendered. I think a part of the issue is that people aren't comfortable talking about it. And we have to, as a global society, have to get comfortable with acknowledging that we all either consciously or subconsciously are susceptible to perpetuating racist beliefs or ideas.
So what's the solution for that problem? Do you sort of educate white journalists or sensitize them towards the topic of racism, or do you need more black representation in the media as well?
I think both of those things should happen concurrently. I'm a proponent of both and as opposed to either or. I'm not of the ilk that all of the people who perpetuate it are not educated. I think one thing we have to acknowledge as a global society is that everybody does not want to be anti-racist, that there are many people who know what racism is, know that they're perpetuating it, and do not want to change. In many cases, people economically, materially, socially, and psychologically benefit from racism. And we can't ignore that. I mean, the same thing with sexism. Like, there are groups that benefit quite well from that status quo. So I think education is one part. I think as a collective society, we have to say, what do we value? And does our society, the structures, which gets into the second part of what you said, who's represented, what roles do they have, what power do they wield, who's influencing, who's being covered, how are they being covered, what communities are benefiting the most, what economies are benefiting the most from our status quo. And so I think representation matters. I think mission statements matter, values matter. I think accountability. I think spectators, if you believe that these things are problematic, I think engaging in economic activism and boycotting and saying we're not going to support teams or stations or leagues that promote racism. I think there definitely is responsibility on the athletes, but I think oftentimes we put too much responsibility on the athletes. Like, we say, okay, you're the one being exploited. You're the one being oppressed. You need to educate yourself. You need to speak out on these issues. You need to, I think all of those things can occur, but what about a collective responsibility, not just on the athletes? What about the league presidents? What about the coaches? What about, I mean, if we're going to put it on the athlete, I think it has to be on everyone to engage in systems change. Because the athlete, the black athlete in this case, if they're the ones who are subjected to the racism, I'll give a couple examples in the U.S. Jackie Robinson in 1947, breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball in the United States. Muhammad Ali in the late 1960s, speaking out against racism, not only in the U.S., but internationally. He actually was a staunch advocate against the Vietnam War. Tommy Smith and John Carlos raising their fists in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City to champion for human rights within the United States and internationally. Colin Kaepernick most recently taking a knee. In all of these instances, these individual athletes bear the burden of representing either their race or a larger group of a collective to champion social justice and human rights, and all of them suffered significantly economically, psychologically, professionally. And so for me, we have a history of black athletes taking a stand, taking a knee, challenging the status quo. What we don't have a strong history of is organizations adapting and changing their policies and practices, adopting anti-racist postures thoroughly.
I mean, the main argument against kneeling and especially like political protests in sport is that many sporting officials, especially those at the International Olympic Committee, claim that sport is a sort of an apolitical space and thus should not be a platform for social or political protest. You, on the other hand, claim that sport cannot not be political for a black athlete. Why?
Oh, well, sports is political for every athlete and for everyone connected to sport. Make no bones about it. Like, it's not a black thing. I asked the question with the Olympic Committee and FIFA, is it not ironic that the countries that typically win are the countries that are more economic superpowers, and many of those countries have been involved in economic exploitations of other countries. Is it not ironic that the leadership in many of these organizations represent certain countries that have economic footprints and political relationships that perpetuate different forms of domination? So sports is always political. If you don't acknowledge the inequalities that are present in the broader society, whether it's through sport, music, art, any other form, you're essentially saying that, hey, we're going to ignore that these other things are going on and just act like this sporting facility that is built in this particular area has nothing to do with the broader social implications and political implications. Sport organizations benefit from federal government tax subsidies, private ownership, which is connected to neoliberalism, economic stratification, racial, you know, stratification in terms of who has access to certain sports. So sport is always political. It always puzzles me when people assume that it's not, because I'm thinking, who do you think is benefiting the most from these sport organizations? I mean, you know, economically, it's not the most impoverished communities that are benefiting the most. I don't know any sport organization that has transformed the poverty within a particular nation state ever. I'm not familiar with one. And so when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists at the Olympics, or when Kathy Freeman, the Australian indigenous track and field athlete, wore the flags that represented the Aboriginal peoples as well as the Australian flag during the international track event, what they are doing is saying that this type of political messaging is important to highlight at these events too, because the other political messages are already being propagated, but it's just been normalized, so we don't view it as political. For example, in the United States, in very few events socially across the country are you expected or required to play the national anthem before. But somehow within sport, at certain sporting events, it's become normal to play the national anthem. I would argue playing the national anthem is a political act, right? You're saying that, hey, we represent this country, regardless of whatever militarily, economically, other things that have been taking place, we're going to celebrate this country and this flag and what it represents. Well, the athletes and the citizens who choose to say, we actually need to question and challenge what this flag represents, who it's representing, who it's not representing, what actions have been done in the name of the flag that have oppressed different groups domestically and internationally, that's also a political act. So sports is inherently political. Every aspect of society is political. Every aspect of society has political and economic connections and sociocultural implications. And the more that we as a society can acknowledge that, then we could advance the conversation as to what political messages are being promoted, what should be promoted, and what are we actually trying to accomplish with these particular activities.
You were talking earlier about how sport federations and organizations, especially nowadays, still profit from, you know, underlying racism, the whole economic exploitation that went on during colonization. How exactly do sport organizations and federations profit from highlighting diversity and promoting diversity?
Well, for one, if you highlight more diversity, you could get more consumers and spectators to follow your sport. I mean, if you look at it just from a market segmentation standpoint, you know, when you say we're going to have more sports for women, guess what? There's going to be a large following of people, men, women, non-gender binary conforming, who are going to follow you now that you provide those opportunities. And the same thing goes for race and culture. So I think there's tremendous economic gains that can be had through diversity. There's a plethora of interdisciplinary research that highlights companies, organizations, across a wide range of industries that value diversity can experience not only economic gains, but also improved morale and employee satisfaction within those organizations. There has to be a concerted, genuine effort to engage in what is called deep level diversity. What many of these white institutions do is surface level diversity. Surface level diversity involves including demographics based on their phenotypical features and their backgrounds, and you primarily force them to assimilate to what is already in that space. That's surface level diversity. You say, oh, we've got X number of Africans and Indians and this, and but deep level diversity would say, we not only want those bodies in this environment, we want those people with their experiences, their identities, their ideas, their cultural backgrounds to transform what is in this space. There are three R's that I would encourage all these organizations to reflect on: resources, representation, and results. If your resources are allocated equitably with a multicultural, equitable mindset, the representation in all levels of leadership and across athletic teams will generate results that reflect what you value. So no matter what an organization says they value, you can ask them three things and it will tell you what they value. Where are your resources allocated? Who's represented at different levels in your organization? And what do your results indicate? That tells you what the organization or institution values.